Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston.
Brought to you by PwC
on News Talk.
Hello, it's Mandy Johnston here on Taking Stock. We'll be keeping you company for the next hour as we look at some stories in business and politics globally and here in Ireland. Coming up, we'll delve into the Russian security services' use of poisoning with the Financial Times special correspondent Courtney Weaver. And also, the revenue commissioners are turning their attention to social media influencers, so we're going to talk to two experts in the area. And in our final segment today, we have Joshua Oliver. He's discussing his latest book. It's called The Hype Machine. It's the ultimate guide to the crypto boom and bust. If you want to get in contact with us, you can email takingstock@newstalk.com. I'm also open on Twitter @StockNT. Now, in the wake of the death of Alexei Navalny and ahead of the presidential elections in Russia next week, Courtney Weaver, who is the Financial Times special correspondent for Eastern Europe, has been writing about Russia's history of using poison as a means to attack their enemies. And she joins me on the line to tell us all about it. Courtney, you're very welcome to Taking Stock.
Hi, nice to be here. Thank you.
Now, Courtney, poisoning as a way to incapacitate enemies is not a new tactic in Russia for sure, but maybe take us back to how it all started.
Sure. So it really traces back to the time of Vladimir Lenin. He started out he was fascinated by this idea of poisonings, and specifically this idea that you could poison someone and their cause of death could be indeterminate. So he created something called the special room, and it basically kicked off decades of experiments on poisonings in the Soviet Union. They were always trying to figure out kind of a better poison to kill somebody off or to seriously incapacitate them. We've obviously seen that over the years. There were high profile poisonings with, Vladimir Markov in London with the ricin and the umbrella. And then more recently in the post-Soviet period with Alexander Litvinenko, Sergei Skripal, Alexei Navalny. So it's kind of been this kind of ever-present part of the security services in Russia.
It sure has. But I suppose until I read your piece there a couple of weeks ago in the Financial Times, I've forgotten kind of how ubiquitous it is within the system. Just how big a program is it in Russia in terms of manpower?
So today we don't actually have an exact estimate, but during the Soviet Union, it was, tens of thousands of people were devoted to this. And it's obviously something that the security services have prided themselves on over the years. The problem we have right now about Russia and its kind of activities like this, both inside Russia and abroad, is basically since the war in Ukraine started, Europe has kicked out, dozens of Russian diplomats, and it's become much harder to track what Russia is actually doing inside Europe, and obviously within the country as well. So at this point, we're just kind of guessing about, how big the program is.
Yes, it's an interesting point because obviously it's a borderless tactic as well. You mentioned there Skripal from that incident in, and I don't know why you call it incident because it's poisoning in Salisbury, which was quite the case, and it got a lot of attention here. You might remind us like what that was, because there were people, innocent people, who were caught up in that who never had anything to do with it.
Right, exactly. So this was back in 2018. So Sergei Skripal, who had been a double agent for the UK and for the Soviet Union, for Russia, he had defected, to the UK, was living there. He and his daughter were living in Salisbury. She was visiting him in Salisbury. And basically Novichok, which is a variant of Novichok, which is a deadly nerve agent, was eventually found on his door. Basically, he and his daughter just got incredibly ill. They ended up in the hospital there. And it took, with all these poisonings, from Litvinenko to Skripal, it just takes a lot of time for them to be able to determine, what is the agent that is causing this. And so this was the case. This was the case there. Novichok comes from the word Novi in Russian, which means new. So it was, literally the new one. And while they eventually did find it out, like you mentioned, there were two innocent people in Britain who were killed by it. They were, said to be going through the dumpster, and they found a perfume vial that they think the agent was in. And so you saw a similar case with Litvinenko, years earlier, where you found traces of, they had been using the polonium, so you found traces of that where, in the hotel room where one of the people involved was staying. These are not, with a lot of these agents, you know, they're not isolated incidents.
And then, of course, there's the stories of the known unknowns or unknown unknowns that we don't hear of. So you start off your piece in the Financial Times talking about an NGO operative. Her name is Natalia Arno. And you might talk us through what happened to her, because she's obviously living in America, and detecting what happened to her was quite a difficult exercise in itself.
Yeah. So she, the incident in question, it took place in May of last year. So she's been involved in the NGO space in Russia for a long time, for decades. She'd been living in Russia and then eventually moved out when, you know, the FSB was threatening her, basically saying they wanted her to start reporting to them, you know, and threatening her and her family. And she ended up leaving. But she basically, you know, her job is just kind of traveling around Europe and the U.S., you know, trying to get people to support, you know, the pro-democracy movement in Russia. And she had this incident last year in May where she was in Prague for a meeting, and she was staying in this hotel there, and she'd been out in meetings during the day, and she came back in the evening. And there was just this awful floral smell in the room. And, you know, she thought maybe the maid had been wearing some really cheap perfume, but, you know, it didn't even look like the maid had really been there. The bed wasn't really made. You know, the trash was empty, but that was about it. And she kind of doesn't think that much of it. She has to go to a dinner. So she leaves the hotel room. And when she comes back, the smell has gone away. But then, you know, later that night, she goes to bed and she wakes up with this searing tooth pain. And, you know, she thinks it's a toothache or something. But it's just, it's so painful. She realizes she can't go on with her trip as planned. And she basically books the next flight out of there to get back to the U.S. to see a dentist. And, you know, when she's on the plane, the pain from the tooth starts migrating to other parts of her body. You know, she said she's someone who has an incredibly high pain threshold. You know, she gave birth unmedicated. She'd once spilled a boiling pot of water on her as a child and had to be in a hospital for a month without medication, you know, in the Soviet Union. And she said this was unlike any pain she'd ever experienced. So she goes to the dentist the next day. You know, the dentist says there's nothing wrong with her teeth, and by that time, the toothache had actually disappeared. And then she goes to a hospital in Virginia and they just start testing her. The FBI gets involved. They're testing her for basically any known, for Novichok, which we know was involved in the Skripal case, any kind of substance they can think of. And then basically the FBI disappears and, you know, she doesn't hear back from them about what her results are.
Yeah, that's the piece I found incredible. There was no follow up. She didn't get any answers and they just left her to her own devices.
Yeah. I mean, it was really puzzling. That was kind of the question that was really dogging me when I was reporting the piece. And, you know, talking to more and more people about it, the kind of the most likely explanation that I got was basically that this is, you know, telling her, A, we don't think you've been poisoned and we couldn't find anything, or B, telling you her, yes, you were poisoned. And it's this, that might not be information that the US, that the FBI wants to get back to the Russians, right? Yeah. Like if they don't find anything, but she was actually poisoned, that's obviously not helpful for the FBI, because it, you know, it tells the Russians that, you know, you have this, you're using these poisons and we can't trace them.
Yeah.
Or alternatively, if they're using this poison and they do find it, you know, then it tells them, okay, the U.S. now knows this poison and they can find it quite quickly. But obviously for the person involved, it's quite frustrating not to have this information.
Absolutely. And you spoke to her after the death of Alexei Navalny, and there's a very good quote from her, which says, "The brutality and everything else, you can never get used to it. Each time it shocks you to the core, how cold-bloodedly they do it and how brazenly." And I suppose that's the thing, isn't it? They're very brazen in their activities. Before we finish up today, I just wanted to ask you, if I can, Courtney, the death of Alexei Navalny seems to have underscored the kind of hopelessness in the sense of any opposition in Russia. And we're having those elections next week, as I referenced. What do you think the status of the opposition in Russia is now in the wake of his death?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think it's a question a lot of the people in the opposition are asking themselves. You know, I'm based in Berlin, and there's obviously a huge community here of, you know, members of the Russian opposition. And there was a big, you know, rally here when Navalny died. And I think on the one hand, people in the movement hope that this could be kind of a unifying moment, a galvanizing moment to kind of, you know, get people to rise up against the regime, or, you know, to take action to feel like it's not this kind of moment of hopelessness. But I do think that this, you know, the death of Navalny in prison, you know, that, and the fact that there, you know, that basically there are no consequences for that, just underscores kind of what they're fighting against. Mm-hmm. And the fact that so many people in the opposition are now based outside the country, because if you are based inside the country, there's a huge likelihood you'll end up in prison and perhaps meet the same fate as Navalny. It's just a very hard moment for the opposition. And it was interesting talking to Natalia Arnault, even before Navalny's death about this, just because of the war in Ukraine. I think, you know, people maybe before the war, you know, people in the West and Europe and the US, they were quite happy to listen to members of the Russian opposition to kind of take their advice about crafting sanctions or whatnot. And obviously now the focus is much more on Ukraine. And I think the Russian opposition kind of feels like they don't really have a home right now, you know, either in the West or back home. And it's this real kind of feeling of hopelessness, especially with the election on the horizon and the fact it's predetermined. This is a whole separate conversation, yeah. But you know, the one anti-war candidate couldn't make it onto the ballot. It's hard to kind of see where they can make a difference right now, given the current situation.
No, absolutely. As you say, it merits a whole other conversation we might come back to another day. But this part is fascinating and frightening, I'm afraid, in equal measure. Courtney, thank you very much for giving us your time and your insights today. That was Courtney Weaver, Financial Times special correspondent for Eastern Europe.
Thank you.
Up next, it's a taxing time ahead for the influencers. Don't go anywhere. Now, you're welcome back to News Talks Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. So, whether you know it or not, you're now being influenced in all manner of ways by people who you may think are just ordinary people going about their day on social media. But this has now become not only a multi-million euro business for the people who are good at it, it's also changing the landscape of advertising fundamentally for us all. But if you're thinking of making a career out of it, then stay tuned, because we've got some advice, because the revenue commissioners are cracking down on these social media influencers. To discuss it all, I'm delighted to be joined now by Mark Evan Corcoran of Taxback and Stephen O'Leary, founder of Olitico. You're both very welcome to Taking Stock.
Thanks.
Now, Stephen, I'm going to start off with you just to try and explain in a very basic way what social media influencer is. How did this all start? When did it take off?
So it's not new by any means. We've had influencers and people who are influential for centuries. Social media has changed things. And the key thing that's different now is the platform. So in the past, traditionally, you were reliant on maybe traditional media. Think TV, newspapers, radio, the people who had the audiences. That's what you needed if you wanted to get your message out. But social networks changed that because they empowered people to build their own audiences. And now influencers can have dozens or hundreds or thousands or millions or tens of millions of followers that they can talk to directly. And really what they're looking to do is influence the people who listen to them.
And how does it change from just being on a social media platform and becoming an influencer? I suppose what I'm asking here is, how do you get attached to products? Do they come to you or do you approach them? How does someone move from being, my day is very interesting, to I'm here showing you a product and I'm getting paid for it?
Again, it's very similar to traditional media in that sometimes people will come to a radio station and say, hey, I want to buy an ad. Will you run my ad on your radio station? And sometimes the sales team in the radio station will go out to brands and say, hey, want to buy an ad in our radio station? Influencers are exactly the same. So in some cases, if they're highly popular and very much sought after, they'll have an agent or not. And people will come to them continuously, brands, organizations, and say, hey, we'd like to partner with you to influence on our behalf. And vice versa, they will go out and actively seek brand partnerships, advertising opportunities, etc. So it's just like traditional media in lots of ways.
Yeah. And then when we're talking about the mix of advertising that a company or a brand or an organization or a political party might look at, how important are the influencers in that mix now? Because there was a time when you'd just be buying newspaper ad, maybe a bit of radio to go along with it, depending on your budget. You might branch into cinema or TV. But are the influencers always part of the media mix for organizations and brands now?
Not always, no. And not for all brands. Really what it comes down to is audience. who are your audience? If you are a company or an organization and you're trying to get your message out there, and that message can be a whole variety of things, buy our product, use our service, follow our political party, vote for us in an election, like you name it. It's all down to the people you're trying to actively target. And what influencers do have quite often is very specific audiences. And that's what brands can often value. So one of our jobs is to understand what these audiences look like, how engaged they are, and trust is key. Trust is at the center of a huge amount of this. You know, we trust our traditional media for the most part. We trust our radio stations and our TV stations and our newspapers and others. Trust is also at the core of influencers. And if we trust the people we follow and we believe what we're getting from them is an honest review or honest information, then we're much more likely to make decisions on the back of it.
And that's a really crucial point because the core of their offering is authenticity, right? So you think that this person is experiencing this product and they're giving you their opinion of it that is honest. But how do you maintain that trust and how do they maintain the credibility if you learn that actually this is sponsored?
So this, again, it's about transparency. I think there is a well-established influencer industry now. And there are hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of influencers online, not just in Ireland, but around the world, who will promote products and services in return for cash or product or a variety of other kind of things. And that in of itself can often be really good. It can be beneficial for everybody. You know, if you've got an audience of people, for example, who are mad into Lego and you've been making videos about Lego for 10 years, then there's an awful lot of sense in Lego approaching you and saying, hey, you love our product. You talk about it all the time. All the people who follow you love Lego too. Can we give you some of the best new Lego so that you can play with it, build it, talk about it, and we will pay you in return? And crucially, you must tell people that this is different to some of your other videos because we're paying you to do this.
Mark, I can I might bring you in here now if I can, please. So look, this is fundamentally, it's ending up as a business for some people. But it's ethereal in the sense that how do you quantify how much somebody is getting paid? How do you, you know, actually assess them in a monetary way? So this is something that the revenue commissioners have begun looking at. Can you take us through what's happening there?
Yeah, and it's an interesting point. You were speaking about the example of Lego there. Influencers, I suppose, are accepting payments in a whole host of different ways, from traditional money payments to, say, free gifts. Maybe that's a holiday, or could be a product like Lego, or could be a particular service. But all of that comes under the microscope, I suppose, when it comes to taxation, and it must all be recorded and accounted for. In terms of the gifts, their influencers are entitled to accept up to a value of 3,000 before taxation kicks in. But in terms of money that they're receiving, that all must be declared for to revenue for tax. And yeah, so over the last number of years, revenue have started to look at influencers. They started to sort of get involved here and try and, address the lack of awareness amongst many influencers about their tax responsibilities, and to try and sort of educate them and help them, I suppose, to address their tax responsibilities and file their tax returns and pay a tax bill where appropriate.
Stephen, look, I tend to think of social media influencers as young people who are on social media having a great time and it all looks great fun. But like some of the figures that these people are bringing in, they're serious business people. You got to admire their acumen and their business prowess. Like look at the likes of, what's her name, Molly May, Pretty Things or whatever. I know she had the springboard of reality TV show and stuff, but like social media influencers is a huge business for these young people.
It is. And crucially, it's not just young people.
Yeah, well, so, that's something else I'm going to come to in a minute about the age and the demographics.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of these individuals have got powerful brands. Mm. And again, we come back to that idea of trust. If you build that trust with your audience and they believe that you're being honest with them and you're entertaining them probably a lot of the time, but you're also bringing value, you know, and that can be a skincare routine. It can be the car you drive. I mean, there's such a multitude of different things. But if they're giving you an honest assessment of the experiences they're having, and they're helping you to make more informed purchase decisions, which again, we would have gone to traditional media for all the time. You'd trust the motoring correspondent in the paper, or you'd trust the tech reviewer on the radio. You know, this is something that we've always had. The medium is what's changed. And ultimately, these influencers now have very powerful audiences. And what's very interesting too is it's not those with the biggest audiences. So it can be good to have millions of followers, and you can definitely monetize that. But if you can show maybe you've got 20,000 followers, but they are deeply passionate about the niche subject that you like talking about, then the probability is there's a brand to sell a product into that audience, and you could possibly be the best person to communicate on behalf of that brand. That makes you very valuable, and you're absolutely right. As a result, these influencers can get paid really, really well.
Mm. Mark, how do you quantify all that? Like, how does the revenue, where does the revenue start? Stephen has said it's the medium that has changed. How are revenue going to go about policing this now? Or what advice would you give to someone who might be doing it and inadvertently not understanding what their obligations are from a taxation point of view?
Yeah, and I suppose revenue have actually already sort of made a start on this. Last year, over 200 individuals would have received a letter in the post from revenue. And I guess the point of that letter would be, firstly, to sort of raise awareness and educate people that actually, if you are earning income through these channels, that you need to address the tax side of things there. Secondly, they also highlight with specific influencers where they believe that they probably have missed in a previous tax return declaring some of their income, and they outline the various steps that they need to take to correct that.
But just say they don't have a tax return. Just say it's a student who has got some kind of relationship with a brand or a skin product, and they're getting free products. Like, how does that work? Do they just slip right beneath the system?
Yeah. So revenue are keeping an eye on, say, platforms like Instagram, and where they see individuals are posting, say, hashtag ad to talk about a different product, that will kind of pique revenue interest. And it is on the individual's sort of responsibility to track what the gifts they're receiving. As I mentioned earlier, you can receive a gift or gifts up to €3,000 in a year. But if it goes over that amount, you do need to record what the value of that gift would be. And there will be a tax responsibility there as well.
Mm. Stephen, just to bring you back in on that, that's something we all need to be aware of, I guess, that revenue are watching your hashtags on Instagram. So you might want to watch out for that. One of the terms I came across when I was looking into this was micro and nano influencers. So can you explain that to me?
Yeah, it comes back down to that idea of audience.
It's the niche part, is it?
Oh. Yeah, so you think about celebrity, right? So you reference someone who was made famous through reality TV. Now, that individual probably has millions of followers. And if you're a car brand, for example, and you wanted to promote your car to the demographic that person has or the audience they have, you could go to them and say, hey, you know, we will pay you a certain amount of money and we'd like you to review our car or take it out. Now, that will work in terms of reach. You'll hit a very big audience and lots of people will hear the message. But if the influencer doesn't talk about cars a lot, then it kind of jars a little bit because the audience are probably wondering, why is this person who doesn't really maybe know a lot about cars or talk a lot about cars telling me about their experience with cars? Whereas if you've got someone who's talked passionately about cars and ideally the make and model of the car in question for a long time, and there are people with that specific niche, then even though they may only have a fraction of the audience, the likelihood is the people who follow them are also really passionate about that make and model. So it could make a huge amount of sense for that car brand to talk to that micro or nano influencer. And even though they've only, and I say that carefully, 5, 10, 15,000 followers, if they're the right type of follower, and critically, if they can influence a purchasing decision, then the potential return on investment for the brand can be incredible.
So final question for you on this, Stephen, if I can. Somebody's on a platform now, they've got lots of niche followers, they have a particular area of expertise, and they actually want to get into this area and try and develop some relationships with a brand or a product. What advice would you give them?
I think there's a few different steps that you can take. There are people who've got agency experience in this, and there are dedicated influencer agencies, both in Dublin and broadly in Ireland and more internationally. Talking to them is often a very good first step. Talking to other people maybe who've gone down the influencer route is another good step as well. I mean, there are plenty of people, and in my experience of dealing with the influencer community more broadly, they are very open, they're very honest, and they look to help each other. So even though they compete a little bit at times for
these brand endorsements, that's nice, and that's unusual in that space. Yeah,
yeah, it's absolutely been kind of our experience at Olytico and my experience personally that they are looking out for each other, and they know there's enough space, that there are enough brands that want to do these things. So talk to those who are already doing it, maybe talk to an agent. And, you know, if you've got the connection, maybe go directly to a brand. If you're already talking about the subject, don't be afraid to reach out to the marketing or comms person within a company and say, hey, I love your product. I talk about it all the time. You know, could I get access to maybe an early edition of the next version? Oh. And that can be how things start. And you see that regularly on YouTube, on Instagram, on TikTok, on lots of other networks where people who are passionate about the product maybe aren't even being paid, but they're being given early access to something. And that can be a great first step into the kind of influencer sphere.
That's some great sound free advice. Thank you very much for that, Stephen. Mark, final word from you on this. If somebody is active in this space now, are there guidelines that influencers could look out for? Where could they go to find out more about what they should be doing?
Yeah, well, just the first thing I'd like to say as well is it's not really about revenue trying to catch people out. It's more
is it, they though?
Want to... Well, I think they more want to engage with this sort of community, and ultimately, if there's income there, they'll want influencers to file their tax return and pay the tax bill that's owed. But my advice really here to anyone earning income through these channels would be to play it safe probably and declare everything. Ultimately, by sort of putting the head in the sand and ignoring this issue, it could end up leading to sort of fines and penalties. Now, as I said, revenue want to engage so that it doesn't really get to that step. But by ignoring it, it could end up leading there. So I'd say play it safe and declare the income that you're earning here on your tax return.
Well, folks, look, revenue want to engage with you on your Instagram hashtag. So you've got a great bit of advice there from Mark from Taxback on that. That was Mark Corcoran of Taxback and Stephen O'Leary, founder of Olytico. Thank you both very much for joining me today. Tóltú i gCéadlóg le News Talk Show, Mandy Johnston. Coming up, author and award-winning journalist Joshua Oliver joins us about his new book. It's called The Hype Machine, and it's all about the rise and fall of cryptocurrencies. Fáilte ar ais go News Talk Show, Mandy Johnston. Agus an ish.
Over time, you also lied.
Do I agree that I lied? I don't know of times when I lied. I think, look, there are certainly times when I was acting as a representative, as a marketer for FTX, and when I was looking for how can I, you know, in a way which is truthful, but, you know, paint FTX as, you know, compelling a way as possible, as exciting and optimistic a way as possible. And, you know, I wasn't thinking about it. I wasn't talking about what are the risks involved with FTX, you know, there. Right. I obviously wish that I'd spent more time dwelling on the downsides and less time thinking about the upsides.
That was Sam Bankman-Fried speaking to reporters after his court case. For our final item today, I'm delighted to be joined once again by Joshua Oliver. He's the award-winning Financial Times journalist and now author of the book The Hype Machine: How Greed, Fraud and Free Money Crashed Crypto. Joshua, you're very welcome back to Taking Stock.
Thank you for having me.
Congratulations on the book, first of all. I'm reading at the moment. It's a great read. You might start us off by explaining how and why you took this issue to write a book about.
Well, it's a great question. It sort of happened to me by accident, if I'm perfectly honest with you. I was covering investment at the Financial Times, and so writing about what people were investing their money into, and this crypto phenomenon kind of took me by surprise the way that it took a lot of people by surprise. And it just suddenly became absolutely the biggest story in town. And suddenly I was a crypto reporter, and that was all I was doing. And I ended up covering this absolutely outrageous, sort of surreal story of the rise and fall of Sam Bankman-Fried and the FTX cryptocurrency exchange, which then turned into this huge bankruptcy case and this huge fraud trial. And so when we got to the end of all of that, I wanted to step back and with the book, Hype Machine, just try and say, you know, try and explain how this crazy story of crypto actually happened. It's the kind of thing that I think if you wrote it in a novel, no one would believe it was true. And so what the book is about is trying to work out how this kind of absolutely delusional financial phenomenon really, you know, took over the world for a very short period of time and then blew up so spectacularly.
Mm. And we'll come on to him in a moment and talk about his rise and very spectacular fall. But that principle of the crypto project in itself, I mean, it is essentially technology trying to create a better financial system. But you might talk us through why it became big at this time and what was on offer here. Was it opportunism or kind of uncertainty about the traditional banking system? What made it take off at this particular time?
I think, you know, one of the key things the book is about is the gap between what crypto says it is and what crypto actually is. And people will have seen all kinds of advertising and promotions about crypto telling you that it's wonderful and it's the future of finance. And that was, as you say, was the kind of idea in the start, which was to try and create a better financial system. And I think a lot of people, the reason crypto has appeal is a lot of people go, yeah, we do need a better financial system. There's a big problem with the current financial system. And, you know, you've had the 2008 crash and you've had all kinds of problems. But the reality, unfortunately, is that crypto has created a crypto financial system that is actually worse, I argue, and I argue in the book. It, you know, if you look at the results in the real world of what has actually happened to the people who've put their money into crypto, it does not tend to work out well. And you've had just so many catastrophic fraud cases and bankruptcy cases. You know, I think the boom that we saw, which was sort of 2021 and into the early part of 2022, was really, you know, the product of this crypto phenomenon that had always been there, been bubbling away, intersecting with a really remarkable moment in financial history coming out of the pandemic, where debt was very cheap, money was all around, the government was giving out loads of money, and you had all kinds of unusual financial enthusiasms that people were getting involved in. People might remember meme stocks, which came sort of slightly before the crypto thing really took off, because people had some money in their pockets, it was very easy to borrow money, and people were a little bit stir crazy from having been cooped up in the pandemic and looking for something that was exciting, you know, to do. And then crypto, you know, takes on a momentum because once, you know, we all remember this from that time that you hear stories about people who are making money, your friends are doing it, and you think, should I be doing it? So it does have that fear of missing out component as well. But I think a lot of people were sold a certain vision of crypto that I don't really think was ever true. And so I think, you know, hopefully what people will get out of reading the book is to feel like they're starting to understand this crypto phenomenon in a, you know, a more accurate way that's coming from somewhere independent. It is not, you know, a story that's being sold to you by someone who's trying to make money.
Yeah. And that's where the title becomes very important and I suppose logical, really. When you get through the book, you realize that a lot of this is about hype. I think the point you're making there about COVID, which is a significant one in the book, is something that we often forget. You know, that was a very significant part of cheap money and this sort of freewheel atmosphere really around lending and crypto just tapped into that moment, didn't it?
Absolutely, I agree. And it's wild to think it was only a few years ago, really, that this was all happening. But it was really, you know, an unprecedented time in financial history with the amount of free money that was being shoveled out the door, quite frankly. And, you know, in the United States, where people were getting these kind of unconditional checks from the government, you know, over here in London and in Ireland, we had more like the sort of wage replacement programs. and, you know, borrowing was effectively free. And that's just not really a natural state. There's no such thing as money for nothing. So it eventually does produce these kind of bizarre, you know, financial bubbles.
Mm. Now, the book is being published next Friday, and the timing is great because it does coincide, I suppose, with Sam Bankman-Fried's case and the sentencing that's about to come up there. There's a great quote in the early part of the book from Fran Lebowitz, which says, "The media requires there be a new genius every season." And certainly, I think it's this part of the book that turns crypto into something, I suppose it's such a page turner, really. You might just start us off. We've spoken on this program many times about him, but for listeners who might not be familiar, who is Sam Bankman-Fried?
So I think the way to start the answer is Sam Bankman-Fried was the head of one of the biggest companies in the cryptocurrency world. He was effectively the face of crypto, the most famous person in the industry, who had won over a lot of the biggest traditional investors from Wall Street to backing a crypto company, who had huge access in Washington, D.C., you know, who was putting advertising in the Super Bowl with American football, and had just become this kind of tycoon of crypto with, you know, a kind of guy in his late 20s who's worth, you know, nearly $30 billion. And then basically in the space of a week, which is, you know, something we covered, it was just extraordinary. The whole thing fell apart, and it was exposed as being that his company was effectively fraudulent. And so then this led to, you know, what was described as one of the biggest fraud cases in American history by the prosecutors, which was a huge, you know, trial in New York that I covered for the Financial Times. And I write about in the book. I was there every day of the trial reporting on it. And, you know, the book is, well, you know, gives people an account of what that, you know, courtroom was like as, you know, this then 30-year-old was on trial for charges that could see him go to jail for, you know, decades and decades. Mm. He was convicted, and later this month he will be sentenced. So the final act of the Sam Bankman-Fried drama, at least, you know, this part of it is coming up in terms of what the judge will actually decide about what punishment he is due after he was convicted of this multi-billion-dollar fraud.
Mm. And inside the company, when it was operating, it was quite chaotic, but he was one of those CEOs who investors just flooded to quite unbelievably. How did he manage to convince so many people of the offering of FTX and Alameda, the other company that he was involved in?
I think this is one of the most, for me, one of the most interesting parts of the whole story. And I think what you see is the way in which success can change people's perception of what they look at. You know, people, it's fair to say the investors didn't necessarily know about the parts of the company that were explicitly fraudulent, but they did know a lot about how the company worked, how chaotic it was, how young and inexperienced the people who were working there were. You know, this stuff was kind of, to some extent, in plain sight, some of the, you know, the chaotic nature of the company. But I think when the person has the perception that this super successful company is a really hot startup, all of a sudden, all of these eccentric, unusual features start to be seen as ingredients of success, where you look at this person who, you know, has built this company basically on a shoestring and just runs it with a very small number of people. And you think, isn't it amazing that he can do this, that he can, you know, create this amazing business, even though it's so chaotic. And so you look at all these different aspects. Once the company falls apart, everyone suddenly turns around and becomes very wise and says, oh, it was, you know, well, you could see it was going to be a problem because of how few people were working there or how inexperienced and young they were and how chaotic it was. But, you know, it really goes to show once a company and a startup has that narrative of success and a person builds that narrative of being a visionary founder, you know, CEO, venture capital investors will all run after that hot company. And, you know, people just think that they're looking for the kind of next Elon Musk or the next Mark Zuckerberg. Mm. So if someone is a bit unusual, a bit strange, that actually starts to work as a positive for a lot of these venture capital investors.
He certainly was unusual. You've met him, you've interviewed him. I think you went to his parents' house in Palo Alto at some point, did you?
I did do that, yes. After he had been arrested, he was basically on bail and he was more or less confined in his parents' house. So in order to interview him, I went and visited there. And it was this, one of the strangest, you know, experiences of my career because, the environment in the house is kind of seems almost normal, you know, and his parents are there and they were very, very gracious and polite to me, even though I was a journalist kind of coming and butting into their lives. And it sort of felt like, you know, Sam Bankman-Fried was like this kind of overgrown teenager who is just, you know, things aren't really working out. So he's moving back in with the parents for a couple of months. And then you kind of step back outside the door and you realize, you know, I'm talking to someone who has been accused of one of the biggest financial frauds in American history, who's kind of sitting in his parents' living room.
Yeah, and that image of him in the book when he goes into the courtroom in his oversized suit, the whole story is just absolutely fascinating. But eventually the FTX system collapsed. Where did the money go? What happened? And who will ultimately be responsible for this in your view?
So the story, I mean, the story of the collapse is very complicated, but if you wanted to simplify it, FTX was sort of supposed to work somewhat like a bank where customers would be depositing their money so that they could trade crypto at FTX. And those deposits were supposed to sit there and just be held securely. And you could, as a customer, you could go and ask for them back anytime and you would get your money back. And it was supposed to be, you know, very simple, very straightforward. What was actually happening behind the scenes was those deposits, which were supposed to be just sitting there being held in trust for the clients, were being lent, in air quotes, being lent to Sam Bankman-Fried's other company, his trading firm, Alameda Research, who was then doing all sorts of things effectively with that money, investing, you know, investing in crypto, investing in venture capital, spending on different projects, on marketing, on political donations. And they got into a position where when the customers asked for their money back from FTX, there was no money there to give them because the money had all been lent over to Alameda, and then Alameda's investments had gone wrong when the crypto bubble was effectively starting to burst. So they got caught and they got exposed because when the customers asked for their money back, the money wasn't there. So there's been a long-running bankruptcy process. It's been incredibly expensive and laborious, trying to recover as much of that money as possible so that it could be paid back to the customers and the other creditors. And that process has been fairly successful, actually. They've managed to recover some money from the investments that was not available previously. The other thing that has helped out a lot is that crypto values, as people may have seen, have suddenly gone through the roof. I mean, that was, you know, the rock bottom point when FTX filed for bankruptcy. And, you know, and since then, Bitcoin is back up at its record high. So the resurgence of the value of cryptocurrencies has actually helped to generate a lot of money for the people running the FTX bankruptcy that will help them pay back more to the customers and creditors when they eventually do so.
Well, we'll have to see in the sentencing what happens to Sam Bankman-Fried and who's ultimately held responsible for that. The book is brilliant and there's a real, I suppose, arc in the story, particularly attached to him, and lots of personal stuff in there about you and how you got involved in the story from your mother's pension point of view and everything. But I can highly recommend it. For now, we'll have to leave it there. That was Joshua Oliver. Good luck with the book and thank you again for your time as always.
Thank you for having me.
Well, that's it for this episode of Taking Stock. Just a reminder that while we broadcast at this time on Sunday mornings, we're always available as a podcast first on the News Talk app on Friday mornings. Next week, we're going to have a St. Patrick's Day special. We'll be looking at the business behind the things that are going to keep you busy over the bank holiday weekend. But for today, thank you to all of today's guests for their time and their insights. Thanks also to the producer of Taking Stock, John Fardy, and Simon Keane and Stephen Daunt were on research with Hugo De Silva Scott on sound. If you've got any comments on any of today's items, please email us at takingstock@newstalk.com. Anton is up next with all of your Sunday newspapers and lots, lots more. But from Taking Stock with me, Mandy Johnston, thanks for listening and enjoy the rest of your day.
Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston, Sunday morning at 9.
Brought to you by PwC.
On News Talk.